It is now with great pleasure that I introduce tonight's faculty speaker, Professor Lawrence Douglas. Thank you. Professor Douglas is the James J. Grossfield Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. He holds degrees from Brown University, Columbia University, and Yale Law School. His distinguished publishing career, of which I would only be able to scratch the surface. He is the best-selling author of 5 books, including The Memory of Judgment, Making Law and History in the Trials of the Holocaust, a widely acclaimed study of the war crimes trials. And his recent novel, The Vices, has made the Best of 2011 list of New York Magazine and The New Statesman, and was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. His list of accomplishments, publications, and other awards is lengthy, but I'd like to spend a moment telling you why having Professor Douglas speak tonight is special for me. About 5 years and 1 week ago, I was at Prefrosh visiting Amherst College in hopes that this visit would help me choose between Amherst and Williams. I visited 2 classes in the morning that were good, but not great. After meeting some students in the evening, one of them invited me to his class the following day and promised that I would like it. The next morning, I attended Professor Douglas's Legal Institutions and Democratic Practice class in the Octagon. Professor Douglas discussed on the lesser-known but still ignominious Supreme Court decision, Lochner v. New York, which I remember to this day. I left that class convinced that Amherst was right for me. As a student, I had the pleasure of taking 2 classes with Professor Douglas, where I learned about the landmark Supreme Court decisions, the rights of the accused, and his research on the amazing case of mistaken identity involving SS guard Ivan Demyanyuk, or as he called him, Ivan the Not-So-Bad. Today, I have Professor Douglas to thank not just for these 2 great classes, many memorable lectures that combined both insight and humor, introducing me to a literary intrigue that was Icelandic blood sagas, but also for the fact that in a few weeks I will graduate from an Amherst Jeff and not a Williams Eve. With that, I would like to introduce Professor Lawrence Douglas.
Thank you, Ezra, for the very kind introduction. First of all, congratulations to you all, the class of 2012. I want to specifically recognize the 5 of you who managed not to receive a prize. You're special too, really. Also, I just wanted to say hi to my son, Milo. My wife is actually performing in a belly dance concert right now, and Valley family. And Jacob, our 17-year-old, is playing Ultimate, so Milo is representing our family here. So thank you, Milo. Did you hear that? There goes the PS3. I mean, that's not... I promised Milo that this talk would be relatively brief. A few years ago, you must have been around 8 at the time, I took Milo to a talk of mine, and I told him it would last about an hour, and it ended up dragging out for about 2 hours. And every now and then, I'd make eye contact with him, and I remember he'd kind of very demonstrably yawn. And then at some point, I watched him take a pen, and he drew a little watch on his wrist. And he was just going. So this time I promised 20 minutes max. You good? Good. A generation is conventionally measured as 30 years. And by that standard, you and I are exactly one generation removed from one another. 30 years ago to the day that you will celebrate your graduation from Amherst, I graduated from Brown. And I still have exceptionally vivid memories of my graduation, perhaps because I barely made it out. I entered Brown with the vague idea of becoming a psychiatrist. I was dutifully fulfilling my pre-med requirements when a professor of mine posed a blunt, penetrating question. "Why become a psychiatrist?" she asked me. "When you can simply go to a psychiatrist." And So much for that life plan. Plan number two was to pursue a PhD in political theory. That was my undergraduate major, and told I had some aptitude in the field, I made the classic mistake of confusing aptitude with interest. 2 weeks before graduation, I was dragged before an educational policy committee for having dropped my senior thesis without telling anyone, least of all my advisor. I was writing on two prominent neo-Marxist theorists, Nikos Poulantzas and Luis Althusser. And at some point, I had come not simply to loathe my topic, but to be vaguely fearful of it. A couple of years earlier, Poulantzas had leapt to his death from the 20th story of an apartment building. And more recently, Althusser had strangled his wife. And none of this was reassuring. Dutifully, I'd go to the library, the Rock as it was called, after its principal benefactor, John D. Rockefeller III, though among students, grown weary of its drab architecture and unreliable plumbing, it was known simply as the John. My Carol was located in the stacks that housed American literature. And first I'd begin with a sentence by Althusser. Here's a quote. Quote, "We have discussed the reproduction of the means of production, but not the reproduction of the productive means. We have therefore ignored the reproduction of what distinguishes the productive forces from the means of production," end quote. The fearful feeling would rise up in me again. I'd put the incomprehensible work aside and grab a novel from the shelf, basically anything I chanced upon. In this way, I came to read Floyd Dell's Mooncalf, Norman Mailer's An American Dream, Willa Cather's The Professor's House, Theodore Dreiser's The Genius. And by the end of the academic year, I'd read about 50 terrific American novels. Only I hadn't started my thesis. Nonetheless, the committee let me graduate. Largely, I think, because it subscribed to what I call the Nasser Hussein policy. And Nasser, and here's Nasser over there, Nasser believes it is less a moral wrong than it is a huge hassle to flunk second semester seniors. A policy Nasser calls, just get them the fuck out of here. It's Nasser, not me. In my case, I'd improbably been awarded a fellowship to study in Germany, so Brown must have thought good riddance. I should mention, though, that the trauma of almost not being allowed to graduate has stayed with me. To this day, I have an anxiety dream that recurs with astonishing regularity. In it, I have to return to Brown to complete an unfinished course, and it's always the same, a seminar in relativistic space cosmology taught in Urdu. So, after barely graduating college, I headed off to Germany. Germany then was a divided country with a huge American military presence on one side and a Soviet puppet regime on the other. The border between East and West Germany was reckoned as the most dangerous spot on the planet, the presumed front line of a future Third World War that would unleash thermonuclear catastrophe. And this made Germans a tad uneasy. And this uneasiness was often directed at Ronald Reagan, our then president, who was committed to putting more and more short-range nuclear missiles on West German soil, putatively as a defense measure, but arguably as a provocation. The fact that all my German acquaintances despised Reagan and generally loathed all things American hardly troubled me. To them, my being Jewish more than made up for the fact that I was German, for they loved everything Jewish, in particular the films of Woody Allen. And Woody Allen dubbed in German is something I wish on no one, I have to say. But gradually, the combination of crass anti-Americanism and exuberant philo-Semitism began to take its toll on me. We had the Holocaust, I remember, one acquaintance saying, and America had Vietnam. And such comments had the curious effect of turning me into a reluctant defender of U.S. policy, not because I supported it, but because I resisted my acquaintance's facile conflations. And it came to a head when a German woman I'd become involved with took me to meet her parents. They were lefties, supporters of the new and at that time still radical Green Party. And I remember her father eyed me suspiciously and said, "Reagan is not our friend," presumably as a litmus test. I remained pointedly silent. A few minutes later, he declared, "Der Weinberger," Caspar Weinberger was Reagan's Secretary of Defense at the time, "der Weinberger ist doch viel schlimmer als Himmler. Weinberger is far worse than Himmler." I reached for a measured response. "That's the single stupidest statement I've ever heard a human being utter," I said. My girlfriend looked down. The meeting with her parents was not going well. Her father, meanwhile, had worked himself up into a near rage. It came out that he was originally from Dresden, and as a boy had survived the Allied firebombing. "But what would you know about this?" he shouted at me. "You Americans live outside history." I don't recall how the conversation ended. The relationship with the girl ended not much later. But in the decades since, I've often thought about that line, "You Americans live outside history." With hindsight, I don't think he meant it as an insult, angry as he was. I think he meant to say that it is a luxury to live outside history, that Americans have had the great good fortune to live unencumbered by huge, life-altering disruptions without realizing how stupendous and precarious our good fortune is. For my part, after my fellowship, I spent 2 more years in Europe, then returned home to make a major life decision. Was I now prepared to pursue graduate work in political theory despite my flame out at Brown? Maybe I should do an MFA. After all, I'd spent most of my time in Europe reading and writing fiction. Then there was law school, which at least dangled the prospect of a future job, not an irrelevant criterion when making a career choice, my parents reminded me. I agonized over the choice, and yet looking back, I see that I faced it unencumbered by any sense of larger obligations. No one was asking me to don a uniform or to put my life at stake. No one was demanding that I subordinate my personal ambitions to some larger collective will or project. My life plan was my own. I would be the steward of my own success or failure. This is what I understood my friend's father to mean when he said, "You live outside history." As Americans, we expect to live unburdened by history's rude intrusions. Recently, in preparation for a talk I gave at UCLA, I watched a silent film clip of Anne Frank on YouTube. Just 21 seconds in length, it is the only known video image of her. And Anne can be seen leaning from a second-story apartment window, watching a wedding party on the street below. The bride carries a bouquet of flowers. The groom wears a dark suit and a top hat. The street's clean. The apartment house is tidy. It's a pleasant picture of unruffled private life. The date is July 22, 1941. The clip is terribly moving, precisely because we know what the smart, vivacious 12-year-old girl peering from the window can't possibly imagine, that a malevolent force she is powerless to alter is already planning her destruction. Now, it's not that Americans have never known history's malevolence. We survived a phenomenally destructive civil war. But that was long ago, and as the British novelist L.P. Hartley reminds us, the past is another country. Even in the wake of 9/11, we've been remarkably successful at keeping history at bay. We've been continuously at war for the past decade, yet remain oddly insulated from war's consequences, even its existence. When I gave that talk at UCLA, I saw something I'd never seen in 2 decades at Amherst, a soldier in uniform carrying his books around campus. Now, true, you can see history's intrusions in small ways. I live a couple of miles north of Bub's Barbecue, and every day when I drive home on Sunderland Road, I swing into the left-hand lane to avoid the axle-snapping potholes that crater the road and that the town doesn't have the money to fix. But along the way home, I pass no fewer than 5 state-of-the-art CCTV cameras affixed to the top of traffic lights, courtesy of the Department of Homeland Security. These cameras will no doubt perform invaluable service in helping to track the flow of terrorists from Hadley to Greenfield. Earlier this term, a Serbian friend, Predrag Dorcinovic, came to give a talk about international criminal law here. Some of you were probably in attendance. Predrag was born in the former Yugoslavia before it was former. He took a degree in philosophy at the University of Belgrade, where he was a stand-up both as a student and as a soccer player. Soon after graduation, he began publishing poetry and book reviews in journals and newspapers. Still in his 20s, he was named editor-in-chief of Yugoslavia's most prestigious literary journal, the equivalent, say, of the Paris Review or Granta. In short, Predrag enjoyed the kind of precocious successes that many of you might aspire to. On June 25th, 1991, almost 50 years actually to the day that we see Anne Frank peering from that window, Predrag left with his girlfriend on a summer vacation to Netherlands. The following day, civil war broke out in his disintegrating country. And Predrag never returned home, at least not until recently, and even now only for a brief stay. Compared to Anne Frank, we might call Predrag lucky. When history intruded, Anne lost her life, Predrag only his home, livelihood, and language. Over time, he reassembled a workable existence for himself. He became a researcher at the International Military Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, where he prepares cases against war criminals and perpetrators of genocide. The office where he works is full of Predrags, poets, former professors, and scholars, really kind of profoundly overqualified researchers who labor long hours assisting less accomplished prosecutors who remain largely ignorant of their fractured lives. The day after his lecture here, I drove Predrag to our house for dinner. It was he who commented on the potholes. "They remind me of the roads in Serbia," he said. "Of course, those holes were the achievements of NATO warplanes." He paused before continuing. "Has Amherst recently been attacked by NATO warplanes?" I assured him that it hadn't. During dinner, Predrag spoke about America, not with hatred or anger, but with genuine bewilderment. He asked me to explain why is it that so many Americans deny evolutionary theory, reject climate change, oppose even the most minimally rational gun control, defend detainee torture, and steadfastly refuse to engage in the kind of reasoned discourse and pragmatic compromise that make possible democratic politics. As a professor, I try to offer a nuanced, balanced answer. "Republicans," I said. I meant this only half facetiously, for the truth is Predrag had touched on something crucial about our nation. Having long lived outside history, it's as if a sizable portion of Americans now live outside reality itself. I was also reminded of a line by one of the great political theorists of the 20th century. No, not Nikos Palantzis or Luis Althusser, though that would be nicely ironic, but rather Hannah Arendt. Quote, "The outstanding quality of a totalitarian elite," Arendt wrote, "is that it never stops to think about the world as it really is and never compares the lies with reality," end quote. I'm disturbed about how eerily those words apply to many of our leaders today. In a sense, I suppose you can place the blame on my generation. After all, you are entering the America that my generation has made. Graduation is typically a time for asking, how have we prepared you for the world? But maybe the more pressing question is, what kind of world have we prepared for you? We have snowstorms in October and daffodils in February. When I stood in your spot, the pay of heads of major corporations was about 30 times the average worker's pay. Today, that figure is 400 times. And don't forget the surveillance cameras atop those traffic lights. It seems fair to say that my generation cheated. Not because we wanted to go on living outside of history. Who wouldn't, given the chance? But because we neglected those institutions, those commitments, and those principles that underwrite our luxurious disconnections. So whatever you end up doing as individuals, business school or NGO, research or medicine, architecture or web startup, poetry or maybe even political theory, I hope at times you think about my German girlfriend's father, about Anne Frank, and about my friend Predrag, for they remind us that things can change in a hurry. Deep down I am confident that you will succeed where my generation failed, because you will have to. I wish you every success. Thank you.